August 20th, 2020. 8/20/2020. Grace's school has finished day 3 of 8th grade. I'm telling you, it's like Christmas every day for these kids. The smiles, the jumps in their steps. Many of the classes are outside. I'm hoping it's 72 degrees all fall and winter. Today's guest is an encyclopedia on the history of St. Louis radio since the mid-60s. And if you're thinking, how is that going to be interesting? First of all, shame on you. Second of all, stay tuned and find out. I had a blast talking with Dick Hewlett. Blues Let One Get Away last night. Might be done by our next episode on Monday. CBL and Associate Properties. They own West County Mall, St. Clair Mall, Mid Rivers Mall, South County Mall. Have files for bankruptcy. I know what that meant before COVID. Let's see how this shakes out. Remember that show on Oprah's network, Welcome to Sweetie Pies? Great story, revolved around Robbie Montgomery and her St. Louis restaurants. It was filmed in St. Louis, lots of shots around the city. Well, I stopped watching it. I don't know, something just rubbed me the wrong way about her son, Tim. In recent years, I see a tweet from the guy and think, I don't know him, must not be reading that right. Anyway, long story short, Tuesday, Tim was charged for hiring somebody to kill his nephew so he could apparently claim a $450,000 insurance policy Tim bought for his nephew, his mom's grandson. I know, innocent until proven guilty, but this one smells fishy. Three things you should if you have not. If you are not watching the Democratic Convention, go watch the speeches on YouTube. I'm not telling you how to vote. Back off. I'm just saying, get informed. Do the same for the Republican Convention. And get those ballots in before October 20th. This post office thing is only going to get worse. Number two, the documentary, The Pixar Story. Released in 2008, mostly known as the Steve Jobs Resurrection Program. Remember when animated films were only two dimensions. Company's first movie release was Toy Story in 1995. Ever hear about Disney's Nine Old Men? If you have not, you'll like the documentary just for that. Also, I had forgotten about how Pixar emerged from Lucasfilm when George was just really trying to do more with the Star Wars franchise. So this is where I ask you to subscribe wherever you are listening to this episode. That helps me get in front of more ears, lets you know when a new episode drops. No spamming, I promise. What good would that do me? Don't forget, you can also check out Dick's St. Louis 7 episode on YouTube, along with all of our other previous St. Louis 7 episodes. Just Google OT with Oliver YouTube. By the way, Dick's got a hilarious story around Led Zeppelin, The Who, and Joe Cocker all being on the same bill. Lastly, number three, if you do like hearing, listening about St. Louis radio, you should probably go back and listen to last Monday's episode with Frank Opinion. Seems folks really enjoyed it, finding out about how the Grady character came to be, how Bob Hyland tried to hire him three times, and what was really going on behind the scenes. OT with Oliver, wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, Dick Hewlett. More than a few of the guests we've had on, Frank, JC, Guy Phillips, they all said, hey, based on what this podcast is trying to do, you need to get Dick on your show, and correct, they were. And he's still enthusiastic about the past and the future, love talking radio, love talking advertising about Clayton Studios. Really glad we did this. Now it's time for today's guest, St. Louis Hall of Famer, Dick Hewlett.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
That kind of stuff.
Did you ever see that movie, Nothing in Common, with Tom Hanks and Jackie Gleason?
No.
Okay, so there's a scene where Tom Hanks is in advertising, and the big fish, the big catch, is trying to leave a message with Tom Hanks. And the message Hanks has on his machine is, hey, how you doing? I can't hear you. Speak up. I can't hear you. Speak up.
I gotta write that down. Nothing in Common?
Nothing in Common.
Okay, because we're always looking for something to watch. Okay. I am ready.
What's interesting to me is we're doing the podcast for about 5 months, right?
Yeah.
And we've talked to various radio people, and there are big names that you would obviously think would come up.
Right.
But without a doubt, whenever I asked people about Dick Hewlett, they were like, you got to get him on. He's somebody. What you're doing, you need to get him on. So thanks for the time, man.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I love what you do. I've listened to some of the podcasts, and it's very, very, very cool. I guess I've been around long enough to know most of the people that other people know.
And if you wouldn't mind, before we get into what your career was and evolved into, let's talk a little bit just about St. Louis radio and about yourself. You grew up in St. Louis.
Grew up in St. Louis. I was born in Spokane, Washington, but we moved here when I was 9 months old. My dad got stationed at Scott Air Base, and we never left.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have two younger sisters. One's a pediatrician, and the other one's a psych nurse, and I'm the disc jockey in the family.
So they moved about as far away from your career as they could.
Exactly. I was the dropout. Both my parents were physicians, psychiatrists, and I'm the black sheep of the family.
Your mom's got a great story.
My mother?
Yes.
My mother was born in China. Her father, my grandfather, was a Methodist missionary, and they moved to Seattle, where she grew up, when she was like 6 or 7, and they escaped. The revolution was starting at that time. So they escaped and then settled in Seattle, and she met my dad in medical school at Portland in the early 40s.
And I miss it. In St. Louis, where did you grow up?
I grew up, we lived in Belleville for a while, then we lived in Normandy, and then when I was in first grade, we moved to a house in Ladue. My dad had a house built. And
my mom grew up in Normandy. I was baptized at St. Anne's, so I know the haunt a little bit.
I was about three blocks from Normandy Golf Club.
Which finally reopened again.
Yeah. Yeah, can't keep me away from the golf course.
Oh, so you are a stick.
Yeah, exactly.
You ever play Glen Echo?
Yes, I have played Glen Echo. It's been a long time, but absolutely, a couple tournaments.
You know what's funny about Glen Echo? When a golfer usually says, everything breaks this way, they're talking about it breaks towards the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
At Glen Echo, everything breaks towards the railroad tracks.
Exactly.
All right, so you're going to get into radio in 66. Let's talk about growing up. Did you know that you wanted to be in radio? Did you catch the bug early?
About third grade, I realized that, actually, I thought differently than other people. They were teaching us the atom bomb. If they're in case of a nuclear attack, that was duck and cover. And you were supposed to put your head under the desk, and they did a big deal about that. And I realized they didn't know what they were talking about. If a nuclear attack, the only reason I'd be putting myself under the desk is to kiss it goodbye. But I realized I was a little different, and I used to listen to the radio a lot. And in third grade, that's what I want to do. So from third grade on, I knew what I wanted to do. My folks were very interested in my becoming a psychiatrist and a physician. They tried to get me to take German because Freud was German and I would be able to speak the language. But no, I wanted to be a disc jockey. I grew up listening to KXOK, KWK, WIL, and maybe a little bit of KSD, but it was all the top 40 stations that all the kids listened to.
KXOK was a behemoth at the time. Oh. I read something like in the mid-60s, you put KMOX and KXOK together in a sentence, and they're two of the top five stations in the country.
Absolutely. Bigger share of this on TV, those two together at their peak.
And KXOK was AM, right?
KXOK, 6:30 AM. WIL was 14:30 AM. KMOX is 11:20. And KWK was 13:80. And KXOK had a killer signal. You could hear them in 7 states during the day. WIL was a 5,000 day and a kilowatt night. You couldn't hear them west of Lindbergh, but somehow us kids could pick them up. And KWK was on 1380 with a 5 kilowatt signal and kind of directional day and night. It was kind of a hard station to pick up as well sometimes. But actually, WIL was the leading top 40 station. They kind of lost, as the story goes, when the Beatles hit, KXOK got behind the Beatles and thought they were a big thing. WIL decided now they weren't a big deal. And the rest is history.
But, tell me what you can about Johnny Rabbit.
Johnny Rabbit. The Johnny Rabbit everyone knows and everyone loves. Ron Ells is still around. We're talking this is 2020, and he's doing a show at KMOX. He was the first Johnny Rabbit at KXOK. He was there for a while, and then he left, and they hired a guy named Don Pietro Monaco, who picked up the moniker Johnny Rabbit. And he's the one that had Delcia and Bruno Grunion and Bruno J. Grunion and did all the stuff with Famous Bar. When I got to KXOK, I replaced Ray Otis, who was their midday guy. And they decided that the Johnny Rabbit thing had run its course. And so they had Don Pietro Monaco on the air for a brief period of time as Don Monaco. And then he moved back to L.A. and taught voiceover stuff and lived on a boat till he died. That's the Johnny Rabbit story, the man with the ears.
So you mentioned Famous Bar. Walk me through this, because I'm only going to get the highlights.
Sure.
At the time, people were not tapping into the youth advertising market, the younger people. And more specifically, when it came to department stores, like you mentioned Famous Bar. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that KXOK was able to put their hat on for was tapping into the younger money, and really the younger money going to the shopping centers, correct?
Right. They did a really great job of it with Johnny Rabbit, because he always did personal appearances. They had Delcia Corlew, who at that point was Delcia Devon, who British, had a nice British accent at the time the Beatles were there. And Delcia was connected tremendously with Famous Bar. So the two, it was just a match made in heaven. And if you're a believer in brand preferences, and brand preferences start early, like people who start thinking about Famous Bar as kids and go to Famous Bar as kids will probably continue doing that as adults. So if you invest in a younger market, you're probably going to hold those people until they get older. You know, that seems to work. Six Baron Fuller was the other. Vandiverts would have been another one, but Famous was the one that hooked on to that and made it work. That was a big deal.
George Harrison's sister was also a DJ there?
No, she did reports. She lived in Illinois, and she would do, this is from my recollection, because I wasn't working there at the time, but she would call in the Beatle reports and give us updates as to what the Beatles were doing. And that was basically, as I remember, it was part of the Johnny Rabbit show. It was almost all on Rabbit's program.
And one of the things that has come up in other interviews, unlike radio today, which is morning drive driven, back in the day, it was really the PM drive, even the 7 p to midnight kind of a show.
Huge ratings at night. The station was really just incredible. It was the beginning of Top 40 was Todd Storrs of Storrs Brewery. Todd Storrs Brewery owned KXOK, WHB in Kansas City, WQAM in Miami, KOMA in Oklahoma City, WTIX in New Orleans, and I think it was WDGY in Minneapolis. Those were all, and they were all killer signals. And they all pretty much had the same jingle packages and were really heavy on personality. They even had the same reverb. You worked at one of their stations, it had its own distinct sound. The big station in New York was WABC, and it had tremendous amount of reverb on, but it didn't sound like KXOK. KXOK had kind of a ping pong ball effect. It was pretty cool.
Did you or anybody you've ever met meet Wolfman Jack?
I met Wolfman Jack, I'm trying to think, it was one or two times. Once, when I was working at KSD, we were in the same building with Channel 5 because we were owned by the Post-Dispatch, and he was in town for something and came in, was in the studio for TV, and then came over to radio for a little while. I did a little bit of part-time stuff for Jukebox 96 because I was in the studio that I own now. I was in that business, but I really missed radio, so I would do part-time vacation work for them. And they had brought him in for something, and I had him on the phone, I believe, for a telephone interview. But Wolfman, pretty cool, yeah.
How many times have you seen American Graffiti?
I have maybe seen it once.
Oh.
My wife and I talk about this a lot because I was on the air in the evening a lot when I was at KSD. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that I missed because I didn't go to movies as much. I didn't see evening TV because I was working. So I saw it one time.
You know, Dick, when I start an interview, there's always three or four questions that I write down that I want to make sure I bring up. I'm 52, 51. When we would drive on Sunday evenings, probably back from dinner with the folks, mm-hmm. what I would always hear would be music that was playing in the front seat while you were playing in the back.
Gary Records Brown. Gary was a piece of work. I enjoyed him a lot. Yeah. I actually never worked with him, but I did some volunteer stuff for the National Council on Alcoholism and Drugs and got him to MC one of our auctions. So we spent a lot of time together and actually played golf with him a couple times. That was a fun ride. But yeah, talk about a fixture in St. Louis radio. He was around a long time.
What other personalities should St. Louisans know that maybe they do not?
Dan Ingram. Dan Ingram was at WYL for a short period of time. WYL was owned by the Balaban radio chain, which is a theater chain, but he worked for them in Dallas. Or was it Houston? No, I think it was Dallas. Then he came to St. Louis, and then he went to WABC in New York, which was probably the top radio station of all time. They cummed so much larger than anybody else. They did a tenant topper campaign for the little plastic balls or styrofoam balls that would go on your antenna on your car, and it had the call letters on it. They did a million of those. That just boggles the mind. They showed up in ratings in Philadelphia. The station was huge, but he was the afternoon disc jockey, did tons of voiceover work. And very, very fun. What's cool about YouTube today, if you never got to listen to these guys, you can go on and type them in and hear them. It was amazing. Ron Lundy was a huge disc jockey, big favorite at WIL, and he went to WABC. Who else was around? There was a guy named King Richard, who if you were in Cincinnati, his real name was Rich King. But he was King Richard at KWK. There's a famous cut, and I don't remember if it's an American Graffiti, where the disc jockey holds up the record and he has a hammer, and you're not going to hear these records around here, and he'd break the record. That was actually Bruce Hayward at KWK, and they went through a thing where they were playing Top 40, and then they got caught, I think, hiding something cheating on a contest. I think they it was a treasure hunt, and they hid the treasure after someone had already been to the spot where they hid it, and they got caught. So they decided that they wouldn't play Top 40 anymore. They would go to beautiful music, and that would kind of soothe things over. It didn't. They lost their license. But Bruce Hayward, there's a cut of him holding the record with a hammer, bam, smashing that horrible Top 40 music. You know who worked at KXOK is Paul Harvey, who did the news for ABC forever and ever and ever from Chicago. He was at KXOK just before they became Top 40. I worked with a guy named Bob Shea, who was a newscaster at KXOK. And Bob was actually there when Paul Harvey worked there. Yeah, I mean, Frank Abshur and the Radio Hall of Fame lists them all, and there are some just amazing, amazing people. John Carney, who's on the air here, father was Jack Carney. Jack Carney was at WIL, then he went to California for a while, then he came back to KMOX. I was talking to someone the other day, what do you mean he came back? I said, well, he was actually at WIL probably around 1960. Who else? Reed Farrell, who got into the advertising business, did voiceover and was the voice of Stuckey's. And if you heard his voice, you'd know who he was. And of course, you got all the sportscasters. You got Harry Carey and Joe Garagiola and Jack Buck. They were all here. I was lucky. When I was a kid, my godfather, a guy named Bill Fisher, I was friends with his son, worked at Gardner Advertising and was there when the brewery bought the Cardinals. And his first job with them was to put the Cardinal Baseball Network together, which was huge. And it still is huge. It's just tremendous. But one of his jobs was to produce the broadcast from spring training. That was a rough job. So he would go down in the winter and spend a couple of months in St. Petersburg and do that. So when I was a kid, I was lucky enough that Bill's son Jeff and I would go up to the broadcast booth and sit and look right next door to us at the old Sportsman's Park / Busch Stadium. And there was Jack Buck, and there was Harry Carey, and there was Joe Garagiola. It was so cool. But what a tremendous history of St. Louis sportscasting talent.
So in the late 60s, you got those kooky kids doing that rock and roll thing, and you're working at jazz stations.
Well, yeah. So what happened to me is this is how I got into the business. I put a little studio in my house. I was like the tinker. I got into ham radio a little bit. And so I had my own turntables and microphones, and I kind of get used to, and I would go in there a couple times a day and just play. And I was like, boy, this is what I want to do. Well, my grandfather was in the plywood business in Oregon. My dad grew up in a little town called Coquille, Oregon, which is 100 miles north of California, 30 miles from the coast. So I go out there and visit, and there was a radio station in this town of 7,000 people that was a daytimer. They would go off the air in the winter at 4:30, but in the summer they'd go off at 8:45. So they had this little bit of slot of airtime that they needed part-time people for. So the year that I worked, my junior year in high school, I worked at a plywood factory, and I pulled veneer and did all sorts of stuff there, but I kept listening to the station. So I dropped by and became friends with the guy that had the part-time job. He said, well, I'm going to go to Chicago, so it's going to be available next year. So I talked to the people at the radio station. They said, yeah, we'd be interested in doing that. And I had never worked in a radio station in my life. I'd been in a radio station twice. And I made an audition tape and sent it to him. I did it in my own basement studio. And so they said, would you be interested? I said, oh, yeah. And said, well, you need your third class license. Oh, I didn't have a third class license. I said, but I'll get it. And I said, I'm in school. And for some reason, they thought I was in broadcasting school. They didn't think I was in high school. So I got the job, and I got there, and I had my third class ticket and everything. And they sent me down and said, go to it. And I'm going, okay. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know which buttons to push and all that. And so they said, well, I thought you went to school. And I said, well, you know, this is so different from what they had at the school. So they had someone sitting with me for 4 days, and I kind of picked up on it. But that's how I started. So I worked the summer of my senior year in Oregon. And then I came back, went to the University of Denver for 6 weeks, took their radio and TV department. And after 6 weeks, they had me in courses like, this is a record player. Here's a turntable. This is what you do. And I'm thinking, well, I've already done that. I was news director at the campus radio station. I had juniors and seniors working under me. And I said, this is not working for me. So I dropped out, and I came back to St. Louis, and what am I going to do? What am I going to do? There was a man named Floyd Warman, who was assistant to Governor Hearns. And my dad was at the Missouri Department of Mental Health, and said, maybe this guy can help you. And at the time, KADI, which was part of KADI and KADY, which later became Curl at 1460, they were off the air. And so a group from Cleveland bought the FM at KADI, decided to turn it into a jazz station. And Floyd Warman heard that they were looking for people. He said, why don't you call them? So I did. And they must have been desperate because they hired me. The good news was I liked jazz when I was in high school, so I knew a little bit about it. But I started working there, and that was job number one. There's a funny clip, the history of the Continental Building, which is where the studio was, which is at Grand and Olive. Old building, wonderful office building, just very unique. It has a little tower on the top. They had a beacon for dirigibles or, you know, for blimps back in the day. And the actual antenna for the radio station was on top of that tower. So I got there, and they had me doing midday. So I did that. And then they said, well, we want you to do mornings. The guy that was doing the morning show got lost on the road. Apparently he was a little hungover and couldn't find his way to work. So I ended up they gave me his name. I became Tom Marshall for a few years.
A jazz guy hungover. Who would have thunk?
Yeah. So I did the morning show. They were having trouble with the antenna. And there was usually a pressurized gas canister that kept the line to the top of the antenna pressurized so moisture couldn't get in. But the station didn't make enough money at the time to buy a new gas canister, so they had a bicycle pump. And every morning they would sign on at 6, so I would go there at 5:30, take the elevator up, and then climb all the way to the very, very top up stairways, and then pump air into the transmission line so they could go on the air. That was the beginning of that wonderful career. I was there 2 years.
You got paid double time for that?
You would think. I was in such good physical shape, you know. I was there for 2 years. I was program director of that when I was 19, which I look back on it and I said, that's pretty amazing. St. Louis was the 7th largest market in the country at that time. And to be a program director, how lucky was I? You know, that was pretty, pretty cool. That came to an end. I worked with Leo Cheers, who Budweiser, we actually sold Budweiser on the idea to make him the man in the red vest. And he was a jazz icon in St. Louis forever. I worked with Spider Birx.
Hold on a second. Everybody who follows the Cardinals know that the Hall of Famers wear the red vest.
Mm-hmm.
Did I just hear you say you were involved in the invention of the Cardinal red vest?
Not the Cardinal red vest. It was the Budweiser red vest. Okay. He was patterned after a disc jockey in Chicago, Sid McCoy. And they decided that they wanted to make him the Budweiser spokesman and that he would always wear this red Budweiser vest. Now, whether the Cardinals got it from him, I don't know. That was Leo. He was cool. But anyway, I left there and ended up at KCFM, which was a beautiful music station. Their tower is still at the Bolivar and Waterman, just off of Del Mar. And I worked there for a couple years, started to look around, and there was an opening for a part-time, for a weekend news guy at KWK. And so they said, would you like to audition? So I worked a Saturday and auditioned. They said, we'd like to hire you. We'd like to have you talk to our news director. This is one of my favorite stories. The news director was a guy named Charles Rand. And so here I was, 19, maybe almost 20. When I went to high school, I was in band. Typing and band were both electives. And since I took band, I couldn't take typing. So I never learned how to type. So I got called in, and the news director said, yeah, you sound really good. I'd like to know if you can write some news stories for us. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you some facts. You go over to the typewriter and type out this news story, and I'll come back and we'll take a look at it and we'll see what goes. So I'm sitting there and I'm clicking with a finger at a time, click, click, you know. And there's another news guy who had been there for a long time, who I worked with at KSD later on, named Emil Wilde. And Emil said, here, give me that. And so he grabs the fact sheet and goes to the typewriter and types it out in about three minutes. Here, hand him this. So Charles Rand comes back in and I hand him and he reads it and he said, you're hired. And so I was there for 2 years till they went off the air. I was telling you they got in trouble for a contest. It was owned by an interim corporation and there was apparently fighting among the three people that owned it. And so they took it off the air and that went away. And
you didn't rip and read then?
It was some rip and read, but you wrote a lot of stuff. There was an earthquake in St. Louis during the period of time I was there, and I ended up, they were affiliated with the Mutual Radio Network. And so I wrote a couple stories that got used on the Mutual Network. So we wrote our own news. KXOK was another place where we wrote mostly our own news. We had wire services and we would read the national stuff, but most of the local stuff we wrote. So anyway, I was at KWK, that went off the air. I ended up going to Curl, which was the old KADY, top 40 station in St. Charles, doing what I always wanted to do was top 40, because I listened to WIL and KXOK, and that's what I wanted to do. So I was there about 3 months.
And by the way, at that point in time, top 40 was not bubblegum like top 40 is now. I mean, it was
No, exactly. There were jingles. It was big. WLS would have been another monster station that people in St. Louis would have heard, because you could pick them up in the evening like gangbusters. They were an incredible station. They had Dick Biondi, who called himself the Wild Italian, was the nighttime disc jockey. He was their version of Johnny Rabbit, but a big deal. So I worked at Curl, and Curl would go off the air at 4:45 in the winter, and they'd stay until 8:30 in the summer. But I was there for 3 months. And the funny story for that, they had a non-compete agreement. And so that if you worked there and you signed the non-compete agreement, you could not work anywhere else for like a year or 2 years, something like that. It was a legal document that they wanted you to sign. Well, I knew the guy that owned Curl was the chief engineer when I was at Katie, so I knew the guy. So I've been on the air a couple of months, kind of part-time. They were making me an offer to do something full-time. And so he called me into his office and said, look, Dick, we've got this non-compete and I need you to sign it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, Mike, I can't do that. I've heard about this non-compete. And I said, this is my hometown. I'm not going to sign it. I just can't. And he said, well, I didn't think you would, but I had to ask you. I went back in the studio, and 2 hours later, the hotline rings in the studio. It's Mort Crowley from KXLK calling me. He said, hey, Ray Otis is leaving. Would you be interested in doing the midday show at KXOK? Oh, ask me again, you know. So I went the next day, I went to see him. Oh, actually, it was the same day. I got off, went out to see him, and we agreed on it. I went back and got to tell Mike Rice at Curl that I got the job. And I'm so glad I didn't sign that non-compete. I was like, oh, wow.
Way to play hard to get, Dick.
Yeah, that's me. Curl was cool. Curl was a lot of fun. It was the kind of the renegade top 40 station. I laughed because we didn't have a coffee machine. This is it's north of, probably a couple miles north of St. Charles on Highway 94 in the middle of nowhere at the time. There was a Zephyr gas station about half a mile from the station, and they didn't have a coffee machine. So if we needed coffee in the morning, we'd have to go to the Zephyr station. And of course, there was no one else there in the morning. So we would put on the long version of like Inagata De Vita, get in the car, drive to the gas station, and come back. That was one of the things we did then. We had one thing. They had pre-sunrise authorization, which allowed them to sign on before 6 o'clock in the morning, but you had to be really low power. And I worked with a guy who called himself Bob Wayne. And Bob was dating a gal who lived in High Ridge. And I think her favorite song was Undone by the Guess Who. It was.
Yes.
So she loved that song, and she got up early. So I was the one at that point that had the only license, the first class ticket that could change the power on the transmitter legally. So what we had an agreement that he would talk to her on the phone, because he did mornings for a while. So he'd be there at 5, and at 6 o'clock, before we were supposed to go up, or maybe it was 5:30, I would power the station up to full 5,000 watts so she could hear Undone, and then I'd back it back down to the low power. But nobody knows about that.
No, hold on a second. Did you have a cute friend? I mean, this is a lot of effort.
He ended up marrying this lady.
There you go.
That's it.
Good for you. And let's time frame this for a second too. You know, Dick, we're living in a world where the radio stations are going off at 4:30 and the gas stations don't have coffee in the morning. It's a different time.
Yeah, I'm telling you what. That's the difference between going from Harvester, Missouri, which is just north of St. Charles, to West Pine and Boyle in St. Louis at KXOK was night and day.
All right, so we'll fast forward a little bit to 1975. You're news director at Casey. Was it as crazy as they say it was?
It was a good time. I've been lucky enough to work in radio stations when it was still really fun. KXOK was fun. KSD was just amazingly fun. And I got to Casey. I had quit full-time at KXOK. I ended up as the program director and music director there. And I'd had enough, so I quit. And I started my little studio. And so a friend of mine was a sales manager at Casey's. Would you like to come over and do the news and do some of the radio production? So I did commercial production for them. I said, sure, I'd do it. I'm going to keep my weekend job because the KSD paid really well. But I'll be happy to do Monday through Friday. So I was working 7 days a week. And I said, but I'm also going to start this little studio in my basement. So I got to Casey, and Casey, that was it, that the people were outside, that we were over by the drive-in theater on Watson. People would be sleeping outside, waiting to have the window open so they could buy the tickets. Yeah, exactly.
they can't see. We're doing little hand gestures.
Yeah. The world's oldest disc jockey, Ruth Hutchinson, I produced her show. She was the mother of the general sales manager. So I knew Ruth from before. And so she and I worked together. There's a picture, I think Frank's got, with Ruth, me, and Ron Stevens. In the production room at Casey. That was a kick. I got to do some stuff. I came up with a traffic reporter named Thumbs Morrison. And Thumbs Morrison did a traffic report on Casey. The deal on Thumbs was he didn't have enough money to have a cell phone, and he didn't have a car, so he would hitchhike and borrow people's phones or use pay phones to do the traffic reports. And Thumbs Morrison came about. I had a friend that dated a lady whose last name was Morrison, and he always used to remark that she had huge thumbs, so that's how we came up with Thumbs Morrison. But we did it. It was Labatt's Beer covered it for a while. But that was in the Casey heyday. That was I was there. John Hewlett is spelled exactly the same way. I was there. My 1 year there, year and a half, was his first year there. I worked with Joy in the morning. That became Ron Stevens' wife, Joy Gridnick. Rick Bayless, who ended up as the program director, was working in Springfield, I believe, and would drive to Casey and work the weekends and then drive back to Springfield and work his other job. Mark Close was doing weekends. I ended up working with Mark. He did mornings and I did news. So it was a gas. I really enjoyed it. It was really, really fun.
Did you see that documentary about Casey pre-82?
Ron did one that apparently is great. I haven't seen it. I know it's out, and I've heard a lot of people talk about it. But tremendous history.
I have to see it as well. I ran into Randy Raley about something else, and he was talking to me about the movie, and I really went looking for it at that time, and when I didn't find it right away, I kind of put it off on we'll do it later down the road list. So I'll have to go look at it.
Yeah. What a lot of people don't know is Ron Ells, Johnny Rabbit, was the one that really programmed the music at that station when they went. Casey was originally a beautiful music station, and they switched over to rock, and he was the one that did that. So he was there for the first couple of years, but that's the Johnny Rabbit. But he was using the name Ron McKay or Raj McKay. We all have different names that we use. I was Tom Marshall for 4 years till I got to Curl, and they wanted to make me Ron Riley. There was a Ron Riley at WLS, but Curl already had a jingle for Ron Riley. And I said, no, I'm not going to become Ron Riley. I said, I'll be Dick Hewlett. And they said, well, that might be all right because people might remember you from high school, and maybe that's good. And that's how I ended up using my own name.
So how did that work back? Did you have some girlfriends with this name and some girlfriends with another name, and you never got caught because they were two different people?
Yeah, I guess that's how that works. I don't know. Casey was a gas. I enjoyed that. I got into the studio business. It's funny, I didn't know what I was going to do with myself because I had quit KSD, which is a great job, but it was time. I'd been there 5 or 6 years, and I can't do this anymore. There was the guy that owns the waterbed store was a guy named Rich Mange, and Rich was a salesman for KSD, and he came to me and said, well, why don't you got a little studio in your basement, why don't you do commercials? You could do that. He said, I'll help you get some clients, and sure enough, he did. And that's how Clayton Studios started. It started in the basement of my house. I was there for 2 years, and it got so busy there was no free time and couldn't use the bathroom in the house because clients were using it. So at that point, I moved out of the house, moved into a basement building in Clayton, a basement of a building in Clayton on Brentwood. I was there for a couple of years till they raised the rent. we found a building that was for sale over across the street from Hi-Fi Fo Fum on Big Bend, and we moved in there, and the rest is pretty much history.
So to try to paint a picture for people, 75-76, if you were going to put together a radio campaign, your rep typically wrote the commercial, and a two-person at most production team would voice it for you.
Yeah.
Reel to reel. This was not right. Art. So you're slicing in your Dyson. I think that's why they called you One Take Dick, right? You had to get it all at one time.
Exactly.
Again, trying to paint a picture, how many other Clayton Studio-like businesses were out there? Because if there weren't a lot, you just must have made a killing right off the bat because of the massive need the market had.
Well, it was funny because there were maybe three places when I started. There was Technisonic, which was over on Brentwood, where the Galleria is now. They were a big deal. Bob Cuban recorded The Cheater at the Technisonic. They did film and audio and TV, but most everything was on film in those days. There was Premiere, which was downtown, and I'm missing someone, but that was really about it. There really wasn't that much going on. People did commercials at radio stations, but if you wanted to go to a studio, you know, that was it. So I was lucky. I became kind of the alternative to Technisonic. There were a couple other people who did. There was a guy named Charlie Hefty who had a studio in his house and did a lot of voiceover. Moving out of the house was probably the best thing I did. It made it a real entity, and people felt comfortable bringing clients in to a building to record something as opposed to someone's house. And I was really lucky. And it was at a time, like I said, St. Louis was a really hot market because you had the world headquarters for Ralston Purina, Monsanto, Anheuser-Busch, Emerson Electric, Brown Shoe. It went on and on. So there was a lot of work that was being done here. And there was a really good stable of talent, voiceover talent. It was a big deal.
On the TV side of things, did you do any of those wacky commercials that we see on YouTube all the time?
No, you know, we didn't do TV. We just did audio because I didn't know anything about how to do TV. We did a lot of audio for TV, and we would, you know, end up syncing audio to TV, but didn't get a chance to shoot too much of it. But we did enough wacky stuff on our own.
When did the internet start to play not just a side game, but a main game?
Well, you know, I couldn't tell you the year. I know that one of the big things, because we were all reel-to-reel, 24-track, reel-to-reel, until a company called Pro Tools came out with a product, became digital recording, and that changed everything. The reel-to-reel machines and the maintenance and the fact that you would have to buy tape and editing was kind of a, you know, you got good at it, but it was really kind of a pain. It changed the way we did everything. Back in the day, just for example, Six Flags was one of our clients, and they had a ride called the Jet Scream. And so they were going to premiere the Jet Scream opening with Rich Little, who was the impersonator from Hollywood. And they had him record the voiceover, "I'm going to be there for the opening of Jet Scream," and blah, blah, blah. However, someone couldn't believe it was called Jet Scream. They thought it was Jet Stream with a T. So he recorded these commercials all with Jet Stream. And so we got the tape. What they would do is they'd overnight the audio tape to us, and then we'd produce the commercials and get it to the radio stations. Well, there's a big time crunch, and we got all these with Jet Stream rather than Jet Scream. What are we going to do? So I went in the studio, and I had another engineer playing the stuff, and I would go scra right over the stream, and we got to the point where you couldn't tell the difference. But everyone's now, if you do it digitally, you just cut the word in and you're done. It was easy. But it changed the way we do anything. You didn't need the bicycle tapes anymore. The internet allowed you to instantly have the track there. ISDN phone lines and a thing called Source Connect allows you to do studio quality work. I could record somebody in LA and you wouldn't know. You'd think he's right here. It just changed everything.
Because I remember in the early 90s, I was selling at KFAN, which was the AM of KZK, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And everybody who had a budget spent a lot of money with KZK. Right. And so what we would do is there would be one designated rep a week who was in charge of coming by Clayton Studios at to picking up the commercials. So that was pre-internet then, if I was still having to swing by at 3 o'clock to pick up the spots.
Yeah. It was funny because all the sales reps would come by. We'd see them on Friday. Sometimes we'd have a beer with them. We'd have beer in the cooler or something like that, and they'd come by. And then it all stopped, and I would run into them somewhere and say, I haven't seen you in 2 years. I used to see you every week. We used to have this notorious Clayton Studios Christmas party, and that went on. Sometimes it went on for 2 days, but they would all be there. And all of a sudden, it all stopped. You know, it's like, we don't see them anymore.
Because the big agencies back in the day, correct me if I'm wrong, Cover Parker, Turek, would you put Adamson in the same category?
Sure, Adamson. Way back would have been Gardner, Darcy,
right,
Darcy. VHN. I'm missing one. Another one, BFVNL. I'm forgetting a bunch of people.
How'd you get along with Bruce?
Bruce, fine. I was fine. I got along with everybody. I really had no problems with. The only one person I ever had a problem with was William Shatner. He did the voiceover for some crime show. He was the narrator for the show, and he was in town for something. And so the Hollywood people called us up and booked him to come in the studio to record some stuff. So we had it booked, and he was supposed to be there at 10 o'clock or something. And 10 o'clock came and he's not there. 10:15, not there. 10:30, we got a little worried. So we called and said, he'll be there. He showed up like an hour late and started yelling at us for not being ready for him, the blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay. Whatever. But no, I got along with everybody. It was a good time. And Bob Cochin, who got into the advertising business, Cochin and Company. Bob started out as a magician at Six Flags and worked at, they had a store that sold magic tricks there, and he did that. He ended up as the marketing director. And when I was at KSD, we did a hit parade of Yesterday Weekend with the Monkees and the Association and Gary Lewis, and Bob was the one, that's where I met Bob. He was running the marketing department, so he was in charge of the show. Then he got into advertising, he became a client, you know. It's that St. Louis thing.
The other thing I think would have kept my interest was it was really one place during work hours and another place after work hours.
Yeah.
Did you ever sit in on some of the stuff Nelly was doing?
Yeah, exactly. The studio hours were 9 to 5, but we had people in the studio till 10 o'clock every night, and it got a lot more relaxed after 5.
So you sold it recently.
Yeah, I sold it 2 years ago to Mike Silverman. Mike and his brother Rob have a group, jazz group called Bach to the Future. And they do jazz / classical versions of jazz versions of classical music and other stuff. They are really, really good. They work with a lot of really top jazz people, Eric Marienthal, and they have a number of albums on iTunes. They do a lot of jazz festivals. They did the original U City Jazz Festival. Unfortunately, we're not going to do the Clayton Jazz Festival this year. They do a ton of jazz festivals. Really, really good. Give back to the community. Very successful musicians. And they are revamping the studio. And it's really cool. It was time for me to step away and do some other stuff. You know? I'm not 38 anymore.
But you did meet your second wife and you're enjoying the second time around?
My third wife is Helena, and we've been together for 25 years, almost 25 years, and been married for half of that time. So
did you guys meet?
We just met through friends. She has nothing to do with the business, and that's wonderful. That's very good. How did I propose?
Yes.
Is that what you say? I had a broken, a lady pulled in front of me, and I ended up T-boning her car. She ran a red light right in front of me, and I couldn't stop, and I broke my hand. So I had a broken hand, and I remember I was so hoping that I would be able to hold on to the ring when I brought the flowers and all that. That was it.
So, like the great athlete that you were, like Willis Reed with the broken knee, you went back into the game.
Exactly.
You can use that if you need.
I will. Oh, man.
Talk about jazz and a couple other things as sure. We wrap it up, but explain to me the telephone line service you used to sell.
We still do. I'm a partner in a company called R&R Phone Productions.
Okay.
Robin Hunter and I are partners in that company. We do on-hold messages for phone companies or for businesses. So if you call, for example, if you call Six Flags and you get placed on hold, you hear me talking about the park's now open. Go to the website for this information. I do a lot of voice work through the company for Commerce Bank. If you call Commerce, I'm the one that asks for your password. I give you your account balance, all that kind of stuff. That's all pre-recorded. We have a number of other companies that we do that kind of work for. Some car dealerships. Actually, we actually have car dealerships in Florida that we do work for. So it keeps me off the streets, keeps me busy.
And it's still keeping you busy. People still.
Oh, yeah, I do that. I do a lot of voice work for the Missouri Valley Conference, the Painting and Decorating Foundation. I do work for them. I do a lot. I wouldn't know what to do with myself if I didn't.
Do you work with Doug Eldon over at the MVC?
I work with, I'm here blank. No, not with him, but I work with Mason Glick.
So, like most things in life, it comes full circle. Your first radio jobs were in jazz, and now you're spending a lot of time back in that community.
Yeah, the last radio job I had was 6 years. It ended a couple of years ago at WSIE in Edwardsville, which was the jazz station. I was there as their program director, which was a great job for me because I would go over once or twice a week for a day do the music. And I did a weekend show. Because of computers, you can do a show in no time. So I did 9 hours on the weekend in less than an hour. So I would do 9 hour. I had a Saturday and Sunday show. I picked the music. I did the production. I did it all. It was great work with students. It was really a labor of love. I loved it a lot. It was a good time and a pretty good way to wrap it up, to start there and end playing the same music. Leo Cheers had since left, but I had worked with Leo when I was a kid. I've been lucky in working with people early on and then seeing them again later and being able to thank them for that. When I went to KCFM, I was hired. I've been in the business 2 years, and Harry Eidelman, the guy that owned KCFM, hired me. And I was grateful for that because it was a great opportunity for me. And shortly before he died, he showed up for SBE, a broadcast engineers meeting, and they were honoring his former chief engineer. And I got a chance to see him and thank him for being so good to me and hiring me. On the show business side, when I was a kid, when I was at Katy, we had Lou Rawls come in. And Lou Rawls was doing a concert, but I got to record him and meet him and all that. And then Lou would come in and do the United Negro College Fund show. It was a deal, I think it was on NBC, but it was a big deal with the brewery and all that. And he came to town. This had to be, maybe 20 years ago, but certainly 25 years after I had met him, 30 years after I had met him the first time, came in and recorded something. He had a voiceover client in LA. He did a furniture store, but he was in recording that. And he called a cab to take him back to the hotel downtown. I said, no, let me drive you back. So I got to drive back and I said, you were just kind of starting out. You'd had your first album and how cool your career has been. And it's just so neat. It's just one of those wonderful things. And, when I went to KXOK and when I went to KSD, I got to actually work with people that I listened to when I was in junior high school and high school, my idols. How lucky is that? Granted, I was 20 years younger than them, but, I worked with Robert R. Lynn. I worked with Grant Horton, Emil Wilde, all these folks that, I knew when I was, because I listened to them. How cool.
What's fun is your voice still has that enthusiasm to it.
Yeah, the voices never get old. They never get old. There's the old thing. How do you get into radio? How do you become a radio announcer? So what you do is you take a handful of marbles and stick them in your mouth and you spit them out one at a time and you try to talk. And when you finally have lost all your marbles, then you can make it as an announcer.
You know, there's a side note. There's that story with Costas about how, you know, he's from New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get on at KMOX. So he does play-by-play for a football game or basketball game, whatever. And this is back in the day where if you replayed the tape low on base and taped it and then did it again and then did it again.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how he got his voice low enough.
One of my favorite, Jack Buck used to come in, and I love Jack Buck. I love Joe Buck. They're great people. And Jack would come in and record the opening and closings for Cardinal Baseball. Cardinal Baseball brought to you by Budweiser, blah, 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 blah. And he would come in, they pre-record those at the beginning of the year. So one year he's coming in to record it. And I don't know if Joe was still in college or whether he was just starting in, I think it was Colorado Springs or somewhere. And Joe was with him. And Jack says, "You go in there and read that." And so, "Oh, Dad, I don't want to go in." So Joe went in, and it was 25 minutes of Jack Buck coaching Joe Buck. It was wonderful. And I was lucky enough to think I'll record that. So I had it recording. And so I did, and I gave that to Joe about 10 years ago.
Good for you.
Yeah, it was neat.
That stuff's great. I love that stuff. Okay, so I got one more question for you before I ask that.
Okay.
You've got some tapes and some stuff on iTunes that people should know about.
Oh, yeah. One of the things, I was trying to figure something to do with myself in retirement or pre-retirement. And my dad was a psychiatrist, and he also helped people out with self-hypnosis and helping them calm down and helping them deal with smoking cessation and stuff like that. So I said, well, why don't I use some of the things that he would do, which was self-hypnosis and relaxation, and try to put together things to help people stop smoking, help them lose weight. The big one right now is panic attacks. And so if you go to iTunes and you search out the Worldwide Talent Group, that's the label it's under, and look under panic attacks, you'll see it. And it's about 12 or 15 minutes of relaxation and then how to deal with panics and go on from there. And there's one for smoking. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. And I just got a kick out of doing it. Mike Silverman, who bought the Clayton Studios building, that gave me some of his music to use with it. So it has some relaxing music with it. And I've gotten some feedback that it's actually been helpful.
Worldwide Talent Group.
You got it.
All right. So my last question to you, I was listening. You said you're a golfer. Most of the golfers I know have the "this was the greatest putt I ever made" story. What is your "this is the greatest putt I ever made" story? Take your time.
Oh, I one of the most bizarre things. I used to play golf with Robert Arlen and Bob Shea. Every Wednesdays and weekends at the golf course, the public course in St. Charles, where Robert Arlen lived. And so we would play all the time. These guys are 20 years older than me. So Shea was probably 60 or 55. And so we're out there. And the one Saturday they called and I couldn't play, I went out there. And so it was Bob Shea and Robert Arlen in the same cart playing. And about two holes from the end, Bob Shea had a heart attack. And he's, you know, holding his chest. And the story was Robert R. said, "Don't you die on me." And he's driving the cart. And Bob Shea survived all that. But it was just like, I missed it. that was, whoops.
What, were you playing skins? Did he owe you a couple bucks and you let it slide at the end?
Yeah, we would play a game where we would play a dime for first on, first in, closest to the pin, and longest drive. So four of us would do it, but it's a huge 40 cents a hole. That was big spenders.
All right. So for everybody who liked this episode, you might want to go check out what we're about to do, St. Louis 7. That's what we throw it on YouTube, where we ask you 7 questions. Again, for those listening, it is OT with Oliver when you're searching YouTube. And for those listening to the podcast, if you wouldn't mind, hit the little subscribe button. Helps me get in front of more ears. No, Dick, we didn't know each other. I reached out. Frank actually was one of the first ones to suggest an opinion, did the same thing. When I started asking around, everybody was like, man, if you can get a good conversation with Alan, that's going to be fun. And I agree with him. I had fun. I hope you did too.
Oh, absolutely. This is great. I enjoy the stuff you have on there. And I urge people, if they're looking for old tapes of people, there's a lot of stuff on YouTube, but Frank Abshire in the Hall of Fame, the Radio Hall of Fame, there's so much stuff there. Stuff even before I was born, which is a long ass time ago.
Oh, it wasn't that long ago. There was electricity, right?
There was electricity.
Good time. Let's go do 7-7.
Cool, man. Thanks. Excellent.
And another one for the books. Look, if you've got some folks you would like to hear on OT, absolutely put it in your review of this episode and I'll look into it. Next Monday's episode, Harry Parker started the Gulf Shore restaurants after he already had turned 50 years old. Why? Gotta listen to find out. As we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.